From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. Our first guest is Max Wilbert. Now, he's the co-author of a new book titled Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. Max, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this book on This Green Earth.
Good morning, Chris and Caroline. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, we kind of mentioned it in the introduction, sort of what a bright green environmentalist is versus, say, other forms of green environmentalists. Why don't you, but let's get your take on exactly what is a bright green environmentalist, say, versus a deep green environmentalist?
Well, the fundamental question, Chris, is will the machines of industrial civilization save us from the harms caused by industrial civilization? That's the question that we're asking in the book. Because around the world right now, we're seeing wild places bulldozed, turned into mines and industrial energy projects, and we're seeing this be called green. So these may not be fossil fuel projects in many cases, as we see this accelerated transition to green energy and electric vehicles and so on. But fundamentally in the book, we're making the argument that we won't save the planet by blowing up mountains. We won't save the planet by poisoning water to create consumer goods. In fact, we need to be headed in the exact opposite direction, using less and destroying less, and in fact, restoring what does remain.
So it's kind of, as I was reading the book, this whole concept of supply and demand, you know, kept popping into my head. And it's about us reducing our demand and not simply focusing on the changing our supply?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Although I think a lot of, you know, theorists of critical media and people who study advertising will tell you that, you know, people's demands are very plastic. You know, the things we actually want are shaped by the culture that we live in. And that can be changed, right? We live in this world that's completely dominated by advertising, and we all are used to technology sort of just being an everyday fixture of our lives. But the reality is the average person today consumes an amount of energy on a daily basis that's almost unthinkable. It's probably comparable to kings and emperors, you know, a few centuries ago.
Right.
So that's not necessary for human life. That's not necessary for our happiness even. It's a luxury. And we live in an overconsumptive society. And so, you know, we're advocating in the book that the environmental movement needs to reject so many of these green technologies that are almost worshipped today and turn back to our roots. You know, I call this a battle for the soul of the environmental movement. The question is, where is our allegiance? What do we really love? And what are we going to fight for? Because in places like Thacker Pass, Nevada, where a proposed lithium mine for battery production threatens to blow up old-growth sagebrush steppe habitat, some of the best remaining habitat on the planet for the greater sage-grouse, which I'm sure you've covered on this show before.
Right.
In places like the Yellow Pine Solar Project in southern Nevada, where 4.6 square miles of some of the best remaining habitat for Mojave Desert tortoises is being bulldozed right now as we speak, this very day, is being bulldozed to create solar panels. And that's not good for the planet. That's bad for the planet.
Right.
It may be less harmful in some ways, but we need to recognize that it's not actually good for the planet. It's just a different form of harm.
Right.
So, yeah, I haven't read your book yet, but I'm kind of understanding that the Chris read it, and I'm new to it, and I'm learning more. Is your book kind of that we have such an over-consumptive culture that we're needing to find new solutions, and those are bright green solutions, and those aren't exactly solutions. You know, the solution is less consumption. Is that kind of one of the main points you're making?
Exactly, Carolyn. I think climate change is really a symptom. Many people focus so much on climate change as the biggest problem we face in the world today, and it's a huge crisis, no doubt. but it's a symptom of deeper problems. It's a symptom of this culture's destruction of the planet and complete wasteful use of energy and consumption of material goods. So if that's true, if climate change is a symptom, then addressing only the surface level effects, addressing only the symptom, is not going to actually solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're seeing. So we need to have a little bit more critical analysis. And, you know, I recognize that this is challenging. People like simple solutions. People want a very easy way to solve these problems that we face. But unfortunately, the reality is global warming, the mass extinction event we're living through right now, all the other harms to the planet, these aren't simple, easy to solve issues. And if we look for simple solutions, then oftentimes they might backfire.
Well, we're going to get into the solutions in a little bit, because the book does cover those. It does list those. But before that, it talks about, again, these sense of the lies associated with bright green environmentalism. And the chapters themselves are simply put: the solar lie, the wind lie, the green city lie, and green grid lie, etc. At first brush, if you were to just look at the table of contents, as an environmentalist, you'd be thinking, oh, well, they must be supporting fossil fuel consumption because they think solar is a lie. But can you explain what you really mean by the solar lie and the wind lie?
Absolutely. And just to assuage any of those doubts people have, I actually used to live in Salt Lake City in Sugar House. And
nice.
I was involved in fighting the Utah Tar Sands Project.
Oh.
I was up there climbing on top of equipment and blocking the construction back around 2013, 2014.
Right.
And I've fought coal trains and oil pipelines and,
okay,
like most environmentalists, the fossil fuel industry is terrible. That's my position. But I think people need to recognize that there's a continuum between the fossil fuel industry and the green energy industry. In many cases, the same companies are involved. The same construction techniques are involved. The same industrial processes are involved. So in the book, we look at, for example, solar panel production. What does it actually take to make solar panels? And if you look at silicon smelting, if you look at steel mining, if you look at copper manufacturing, Utah Salt Lake Valley residents know better than anyone from the Kennecott mine what the harms are of copper mining and strip mining in general. The scale of the green energy transition that is being proposed isn't understood by most people. There's one plan to transition the entire country to wind, solar, and hydropower would require new wind turbines in California alone, covering an area four times the size of Yosemite National Park. That's more than 4,000 square miles. That's just in the state of California, and that's just for wind energy. There are examples from all around the world. Another one, if you look at these plans, again, to transition to 100% renewable energy on the wind energy side, that transition would require material inputs equivalent to building about 60,000 Hoover dams in the next 9 years. That's one of the proposals being put out there. That's about 12 Hoover dams per day, right? So we need to critically look at the solutions that are being put forward and recognize, again, this isn't good for the planet. This is extremely destructive to the planet, just in a different type of way than fossil fuels. And if we rely on these false solutions, then we're really preventing ourselves from thinking about, from putting our energy and our policy and all of our efforts towards actually addressing the roots of the problem that we face.
We're speaking with Max Wilbert. He is the co-author of the new book, Bright Green Lies: How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. So again, I'm reminded of a friend of mine who worked for a rooftop solar company in Florida. And the first thing he would do, he would go to a home, and he would sit down with the homeowners, and they would first figure out their energy demand, right? How much electricity do they use each day? And then he would calculate, turn that into, well, you'll need, for example, you'll need 20 solar panels on your roof to accommodate that demand. And then he would say, but if you made small changes in your behavior and you reduced your demand and your consumption, instead of 20 panels, you only need 14. And he said, the pushback I got at times, not all the times, but pushback I got was fascinating, because I thought I was delivering good news to them, because I was, in effect, saving them money and energy. But they would say, paraphrase, they would say, I'm not interested in reducing my demand. I just want to change my supply in such a way that it's a greener form of energy, and I don't have to reduce my demand and my consumption of electricity. So is that, again, that sounds like an example of a bright green mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. And we share in the book the story of an engineer friend of ours, Ozzie Zahner, who used to do the exact same thing, solar panel installations. And he went to a home which had these beautiful trees on the south side of the house. And they would have had to been cut down to put in the solar panels. Mm. And he crunched the numbers and found that not only did keeping those trees in place provide a better benefit in terms of global warming, it also provided a bigger benefit to the homeowners in terms of reducing their energy bill, because they got shade in the summer,
right.
They got sun in the winter, there were deciduous trees, right? And the homeowner said, you know what? Go ahead and cut them down anyway, right? They weren't actually interested in the real information. And that's what we need to overcome, is there's so much misinformation out here. And again, these bright green lies, they're not just sort of some abstract problem. They're actually resulting in a lot of real world harm right now.
Right.
So many people are in this mindset that wind and solar and electric cars are going to save the world. And that's a really simple narrative that people can follow, and we're following it to the end of the world.
Yeah, we kind of started to touch a little bit that, you know, overconsumption across the board seems to be a problem, and kind of, you know, in your story with your friend and Chris's friend, that disconnect from what role things around us play in, you know, helping us do what we want to do. You know, the trees, you know, providing shade. I mean, unaware about that, or adding more panels to reach the consumption.
Right. And a reluctance to want to change our behaviors in a way that, you know what, maybe we need to use less electricity and less water, and I need to drive less, rather than simply just buy an electric car.
Right. So does your book touch on solutions at all? Do you kind of start with behavior change as a solution, or are the solutions broader than that?
Well, the first thing that we say, Carolyn, is that we need to shift our allegiance. So many people in this culture, their first allegiance when it comes down to it is to their cell phone, is to the internet, is to their ability to plug something into the wall and have it be powered. People's experience on a day-to-day basis is that their food comes from the grocery store, their information comes from the internet, their water comes from the tap. This is all an illusion, of course. The reality is that we are completely dependent upon the living planet, right? You know this. All the listeners know this. Two-thirds of the breaths that we take are only possible because of plankton in the oceans creating oxygen for us. And the rest comes from the forest and all the other living beings, right? We can only live if we have clean water, if we have food. All of this depends on a healthy biodiversity, healthy natural communities. This world just so lush with living species of so many different types. That's where our life comes from. That's where our ability to exist into the future comes from. And that's also where, if we're going to have any hope of overcoming this climate crisis, stopping the biodiversity spiral that we're just plummeting into, stopping all of the ecological problems that are tearing through our planet right now, it's going to come from the natural world. And so we need to shift our allegiance from the culture of machines to the natural world. And then all of our policies, all of our individual behaviors, all of these things follow from that fundamental shift in our allegiance, in where we put our love and our trust and our respect. And, you know, that is a major shift. That's that's not a common mindset in our culture, but it is in many other cultures throughout human history. I mean, this is why at Standing Rock, the slogan was water is life. It's a very simple recognition that we are completely dependent upon the living world. And if we don't respect the living world and live in a reciprocal way with it, then we and everyone else are going to have to live with consequences or perhaps die with the consequences.
Right. Just a minute or two remaining, and you, the book emphasizes part of the solutions is to reduce deforestation, increase reforestation, and also protecting and doing what we can to reintroduce wetland systems and estuaries and peat bogs and all those natural ecosystems that bring tremendous benefit as far as carbon uptake, etc. Letting the planet first, you know, heal itself, and by doing so, providing us a sustainable planet too.
Absolutely. And as part of that, you can't do that without stopping the destruction.
Right.
You know, for people who live around Salt Lake City, all that oil that's being pumped out of the Uinta Basin, those oil refineries on the north side of town, the Kennecott Mine, all of these massive industrial projects need to get shut down. They need to be stopped. And people are the ones who are going to do that. Governments aren't going to do it for us. Corporations aren't going to do it for us. You are going to have to do it. We are going to have to do it. And, you know, of course, we're dependent on so many of these things. So alongside that, we need to relocalize our food systems. We need to change the way we live. But it all flows from that fundamental change in our values. What do we value? Do we value a living planet? Or do we value a world of machines?
Well, the name of the book is Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. Max Wilbert is one of the co-authors of the book, along with Derek Jensen, and I believe it's Lierre Keith. Max, thanks so much for joining us this morning. The book is available. It's on sale today. And thanks for localizing the story, too. Being from Salt Lake and Sugar House, always appreciate that. And thanks for all.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. And
thank you, Joe.
We'll be in touch. We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.